clerk to call the case.
The court will now call Stanley Lord Hilton for direct funding contracting. Commencing the court, Mr. Jerry Jarzombek to argue for the appellate, Mr. Brian Benitez to argue for the appellate.
You may begin.
May it please the court. Good morning, Chief Justice Sutter, Justice Womack, Justice Walker. I'm Jerry Jarzombek from Fort Worth, and I represent the appellant, Stanley Hilton, in the case before the court this morning, seeking for this court to reverse and remand the October 22nd, 2020 judgment from the trial court for three reasons. And the first is that the trial court erred in confirmation of an arbitration award. Secondly, because the trial court erred in entering a take-nothing judgment on Mr. Hilton's counterclaim. And finally, because the evidence is both legally and factually insufficient to support the judgment. The facts of this case begin with Mr. Hilton owning a home in Halton City that is damaged when an 18-wheeler pulls some overhead electrical lines and damages his home. His homeowner's insurance puts him up in a Homewood Suites, where he is visited by a fellow by the name of Paul Mitchell.
I don't want to interrupt you here. I think we're pretty familiar with the facts of the case. And what I really want to know is, did Mr. Hilton voluntarily go to arbitration and participate in arbitration?
Well, he went, but I don't consider his actions voluntary. While it's hard for me to assess exactly what the other counsel did at that time, he did file a counterclaim. If one looks at the attachments at the motions to confirm and the amended motion to confirm, talking about how Mr. Hilton did not sign the arbitration agreement, did not agree to go to arbitration, and he raised that as an issue in the arbitration.
Right, but he attended the arbitration, right?
It would appear that he did, yes.
And they arbitrated that issue.
Well, they did, but they shouldn't have, because whether or not the case is or an agreement exists to arbitrate exists only for the trial court's determination, absent some delegation clause or something that would delegate that determination to the arbitrator. But that didn't exist in this case. The clause in this case only said that all matters arising from this agreement should go to arbitration. So the existence of the agreement or the contract to arbitrate should have been a decision that was made by the trial court, and that didn't happen. What's perhaps most troubling here is when I became involved in this case, and you look at the register of actions in the trial court, you have first plaintiff's original petition, followed immediately by, not defendant's answer, but a motion to confirm the arbitration award. Now, the only case that I found that even dealt with a good explanation, and it's not cited in my brief, but it's from this court, was a case, Legoland Discovery Center versus Superior Builders, and it was talking about a waiver of the right to arbitrate. And one of the considerations is whether a plaintiff waives that right when they invoke the judicial process by filing a lawsuit. Of course, the opinion also said that there's a list of things to look at, and the totality of the circumstances is what determines that. And I don't know that you get that solely on that particular line of reasoning. But what I think is even more troubling is that the trial court here was unaware that the parties had gone to arbitration and stated that on the record during our October 2000 hearing.
Right, but if the parties show up for arbitration and participate in arbitration, do you really need a motion to compel it?
Yes.
I mean, because the parties have agreed to it. They've shown up. They've shown that they're wanting to arbitrate because they're at the arbitration hearing. So why do they need a motion to compel it when they do it voluntarily?
Because it's a jurisdictional issue.
Do you have a case that says it's jurisdictional?
Well, Your Honor, the fact is that a trial court acquires jurisdiction of a cause of action to the exclusion of all other courts at the time that it's filed.
And but arbitration isn't a court. It's an alternative dispute resolution process.
That's exactly right. And so during the time that the trial court had the jurisdiction of this case, and it was exclusively in the trial court, they chose to go to another forum.
Right, but they could choose to mediate,
which
is also not a dispute resolution.
That is exactly correct.
And that would not be a jurisdictional problem. You don't have to do a motion to compel mediation if the parties go to mediation. Why is arbitration different?
Because you're going to a tribunal that will pass on the facts and make findings that are legally binding, unlike mediation.
But do you have a case that says that?
I'm sorry, that says...
That says that because it's a tribunal, it's treated differently?
Well, I do not. And I will tell you that in preparation for this case and the brief, I researched every place I could find to find any court that had ever dealt with a situation where parties went to arbitration without a motion to compel or at least letting the trial court know that they were going, and I could find none. I have no authority for you, and it isn't because we didn't spend time looking for that authority, but I can't find it. And I'm always reluctant to come to the court and say, oh, this is a case of first impression, and it's very important that we write on this because I can't find one, and if somebody can, it would be news to me because we've looked very hard for that case. I've never heard of any court who has jurisdiction of a case allowing another fact finder to have it. And I analogize that in my arguments in the trial court, that if somebody wanted to go and get out of the family court's building, if that's where the court was at the time, and go somewhere else because they liked that particular location better, would that be okay?
So is your position that you don't think there's ever been a case where two parties get involved in a lawsuit and someone says, oh, wait a minute, we have an arbitration agreement, and the other side looks at it and says, yeah, in fact we do, let's just go to arbitration. They go to arbitration, they come back to the court and say, let's confirm this award, and they never involve the court in it. You don't think that's ever happened?
If it has, I can't find it.
Okay, well, you wouldn't find it, would you? Because all you'd see is a confirmation of an arbitration award, and it wouldn't make the case books. It would stay at the trial court level because they agreed to go to arbitration. They agreed to be bound by it.
And that may be exactly why I can't find that. But I still don't think that resolves the jurisdictional issue.
And every time that happens, you think there's a jurisdictional problem?
I think there is not a problem if the court rules on a motion to compel arbitration or passes on the validity of the arbitration agreement. And that's what one of the problems we had in this case was Mr. Hilton saying, I didn't sign that. And he said that in the arbitration. We said that again when we filed our amended answer and filed a verified denial of that fact that he didn't execute the agreement to arbitrate. So he shouldn't have been forced to go to arbitration, being that it is a creature of statute and a contractual agreement is what takes you there. And he says he didn't agree. The arbitrator should not have made that decision.
Counselor, I think you'd probably concede that there is a public policy that favors any kind of alternative dispute resolution in the state of Texas. And courts are usually, in the interest of judicial efficiency, trying to get cases moved in any way that they possibly can. I once heard a story, and I don't even know if it's true, but there were two attorneys, two litigants at trial. They said, we might be able to settle this. They go out in the hallway. They agree to flip a quarter. If it's heads, this person wins. If it's tails, this person wins. And they did, and the person that got heads won. However it played out, whether that's true or not, I mean, wouldn't you agree that if two parties agree to go to any kind of forum, for that matter, in order to further settlement, then that's their prerogative. They have that capacity, as long as the court doesn't order that they can't. Wouldn't you agree with that?
In large part, the resolution, first of all, by any alternative method, is favored, and the cases all say that. But what we have in this case that's different is having another tribunal pass on the facts and the law during the period of time that this case is pending in a district court in this county. That's the difference.
Because of the binding nature or because they're actually finding facts, or both?
Both. I think that's what sets this apart. Now, I will agree with Chief Justice Sutter that that perhaps is why one can't find that type of arranged reported case, because maybe it never gets there. But it still, I think, forms a jurisdictional issue that has to be dealt with. The next thing that is difficult is the resolution of the counterclaim in a take-nothing judgment. Now, there was no was no evidence submitted during the October 22nd, 2020 hearing. The only evidence that would have been submitted is the evidence that was appended to Mr. Hilton's partial motion for summary judgment. Now, the evidence that is, or would have, if we call it evidence, attached to the motion to confirm the arbitration award wasn't admitted. And things that you staple to a pleading aren't evidence unless they're admitted by the trial court. And the record doesn't reflect that all of those things were admitted. So there was no evidence upon which the trial court could base its decision to summarily dismiss the counterclaim.
Now, the appellee says that it's basically, I think, I'm paraphrasing the verbiage, but it's a legal document, in essence. And because it's a legal document, courts have the capacity to take those in consideration, whether or not they're proven up through proper evidentiary channels or quote-unquote admitted. It's something that the court can consider. And do you disagree with that?
Well, yes, I do, because if it were a judgment from another court, one would ask the trial court to take judicial notice of a judgment from another court. But this doesn't really have the characteristics, or shouldn't be given the judgment or the characteristics of a judgment from a sister court, and that is what they call it in their brief, is that it should be confirmed just like a judgment from a sister court. But two proceedings aren't going on in sister courts simultaneously, and that being the problem with this particular case. Now, if the trial court wanted to say that the summary judgment was not able to be granted and overrule it, the summary judgment, that still wouldn't affect the pendency of the counterclaim, and that should have been left alone. And for that reason, it would have been an abuse of discretion to summarily dismiss the counterclaim without any evidence to support that. The findings in this case also, there's a finding that the court entered that says that the parties entered into a contract and there was an agreement for arbitration. That was contested all the way, and so the court could not have found that. They couldn't have listed all of the findings from the arbitration for a lot of reasons. First of all, there was no reported reporter's record from the arbitration. It's just a series of documents, none of which were authenticated. Had plaintiffs elected to bring this as a summary judgment, maybe we would have a different argument, but they didn't bring it as a summary judgment. They just had documents appended from the arbitration, and then they had the trial court make findings, including that the trial court even analyzed the arbitration award and equated it to a judgment from a sister court. They mentioned also that...
Counselor.
Before you run out of time, I have a question. I didn't see that you filed a motion to vacate, modify, or correct the arbitration award. Did you file one?
I did not.
And did you waive a lot of your arguments by failing to file one?
Well, I would have waived the arguments that the arbitrator acted incorrectly or unjustly, but my involvement in this case came after that 90-day period had run, and I thought it'd be a little bit, when the statute's pretty clear, I did not file it only because the time to do so had already run.
But by failing to file that, doesn't that waive most of your rights to contest any kind of confirmation of the arbitration award?
No, because one of the waivers that we didn't waive is we don't waive the jurisdiction of the trial court. That waiver never occurred, and so the trial court didn't lose jurisdiction, and we didn't waive our jurisdictional standing to be in the trial court. And for all those reasons, we ask this court to look and say that the plaintiff could not have instituted arbitration proceedings without a motion to compel arbitration. They couldn't compel an arbitration award without authentication. They erred in dismissing the counterclaim, and the evidence was insufficient.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brian Benitez. I am not from Fort Worth. I am from that little town somewhat east of here that shall not be named. I represent the Appellee Correct General Contracting LLC and here to argue for the court to show why the court should affirm the trial court's motion to confirm my client's arbitration award and to deny appellant the relief that he seeks both in his brief submitted to this court today and also in all of his post-arbitration motion and pleading practice for three reasons. First, we'll show that the arbitration award was properly confirmed and that the trial court's decision with that regard should be affirmed. Second, appellant requested a significant amount of post-arbitration relief, which I'll detail a little further in the argument, but more specifically, after arbitration, after the arbitrator's award was issued on August 26, 2019, Mr. Turner as post arbitration counsel and filed an answer, quote-unquote, well, an answer had already been filed in the arbitration, a first amended answer, counterclaims, and an MSJ, and will argue to the court that all the relief requested therein is improper and should be barred on doctrines including res judicata, ratification, waiver, Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 94, and the rules of the AAA, the American Arbitration Association. And third, that the arbitration award itself, which was entered, was not a hearsay document, and that the court properly overruled Mr. Jerzombek's hearsay objection during the hearing. Before I get into my points, I'd like to address some of the things Mr. Jerzombek brought up in his argument. He made the point that, if I'm hopefully paraphrasing correctly, that a lot of his argument is based on this theory that when two parties go and file a lawsuit in a district court, that they are somehow barred from arbitrating that claim after a motion to compel arbitration from the court. Cited to a lot of authority, but all that authority was distinguishable because it was in the words and the language of compulsion. It was where one party wanted to go and the other party resisted, which of course is a proper situation for the trial court to jump in and say you're either going or you're not. But in a situation where the parties agree to go, we have cited to several cases which stand for the proposition that neither the Texas Arbitration Act nor the Federal Arbitration Act requires an actual motion to compel to send parties to arbitration. Judge Chupp agreed with that proposition during argument. You'll see in the reporter's record where essentially he said, if the adults in the room decide to go take a matter to arbitration, they can go, and Judge Chupp went a step further. And what he said was, and of course, his opinion is not argumentation here, but to highlight the point, he said, even if there's not an arbitration agreement per se in the contract, that parties go to court and it doesn't have an arbitration agreement in the contract at issue, they could still elect to go to ADR, to an arbitration, to resolve their issues. Mr. Jerzombek pointed out that he couldn't find any cases related to the fact pattern that we're discussing. Go to trial, and then the parties decide to arbitrate, don't inform the court, voluntarily go to arbitration, come back to confirm. On our brief, page 14, paragraph 37, we cite to several cases, and one of them is the Carter case. Carter's EB National Association 578 Southwest 3rd, 613 at 622. For the proposition, quote, nothing in the FAA or TAA requires an order compelling arbitration. Mr. Drzombic argued, the way that I interpreted it, that there's some deficiency because there's not a court-reported record of the arbitration. However, it's the law in Texas on the Loudermill case that we cited to in our brief, which is 208 Southwest 3rd, 696 at 705. And it says that absent a transcript, the court must presume that there is adequate reasoning and evidence to support an arbitration award. And then the factual side of that, of course, is that it's not any particular party's burden to produce that sort of record from an arbitration. Either side could have, and neither side did. So the casting of aspersion or blame, the fact that we didn't produce a record, that either side could have produced it, nobody did.
Counselor, I think Mr. Drzombic's argument is that these cases don't necessarily apply because in these particular cases, the courts didn't have jurisdiction yet. The case wasn't actually pending under the authority of the court yet. Is that not correct? Are these cases where there had been a lawsuit filed and then during the pendency of that lawsuit, there was an arbitration that ensued, whether it was ordered or, I mean, I guess it wasn't ordered?
In Carter, the sides were in court and then decided to go arbitrate.
Okay.
And then in that same paragraph, there's a little bit of a string side that comes out of Carter, but it's not a case of first impression. I understand why Justice Sutherland might say they're not super common to find. I mean,
sure.
I'm not involved in a number of them. A lot of practitioners are, but they don't matriculate their way up through the appeals process, so there's no decisions to research in general, but we did find a few.
Yeah, usually if you agree to arbitrate, you're going to agree with the outcome. I mean, you're stuck to the outcome, and right. You don't appeal it.
There's another issue he brought up. I'm not 100% sure if I understood it correctly, but it seems to go like this, that you could potentially go to arbitration voluntarily, as he argues it, if there's some kind of disclaimer or some kind of reservation or some language in the arbitration clause which allows that. Now, and what he said was, and he didn't, Mr. Drzombic didn't give the court the benefit of the actual language of the arbitration clause itself, appears in the clerk's record at 155. And in pertinent part, it says the arbitration shall be held under the rules of the American Arbitration Association. So that's a specific grant of authority to the AAA under the AAA rules, which were effective for this. We use the construction rules. And you'll see that on page 180, which is Mr. Fuller. That was the arbitration counsel's, the person who filed the answer and counterclaims on behalf of Mr. Hilton during arbitration, who represented him during the arbitration. Those were the rules that were in effect, the construction industry rules, fast track. Rule 1, R1 of the AAA, which is incorporated into the agreement, says the parties shall be deemed to have made these rules a part of their arbitration agreement whenever they have provided for arbitration by the AAA under its construction arbitration rules, or wherever they have provided for arbitration of a construction dispute pursuant to the rules of the AAA without designating particular AAA rules. So if you incorporate the AAA rules into your arbitration contract, you fall under AAA rules and they're considered incorporated into the clause. R9 is the rule on jurisdiction. R9 says the arbitrator shall have the power to rule on his or her own jurisdiction, including objections with respect to the existence, scope, or validity of the arbitration agreement. Importantly, in our case, 9C says that a party must object to the jurisdiction of the arbitrator or to the arbitrability of a claim or counterclaim no later than the filing of the answering statement to the claim or counterclaim, which gives rise to the objection. And if the court in their analysis goes to page, I believe it is 180, of the clerk's record, you will see the answer filed by attorney Roger Fuller on behalf of appellant Stanley Hilton. Nowhere in there does he object to the arbitration, or excuse me, to the jurisdiction of the AAA or to the jurisdiction of the arbitrator or to the arbitrability of the matter. All he says was, you filed the claim and didn't attach some documents that are necessary to get into fast track. So he requests additional time, but he never objects. And then in a matter of abundance of caution, he goes and files his answer. And then from there, we went to arbitration. I personally was there and was opposed to him in arbitration. Moving on to three points that I would like to present briefly to the court in the time remaining. The arbitration award was properly confirmed. The arbitrator signed the award on August 26, 2019. We have cited to authority in our brief confirming that arbitration awards are, in fact, accorded the same dignity as a court of final resort, is the way that the case law refers to it. In the arbitration agreement, there's a few recitations which are important. One of those is where the arbitrator recites that she was designated in accordance with the rules of the AAA and with the arbitration agreement agreed and entered into between the parties. The next recitation on the face of the award is that the counterclaims of the respondent, including claims for attorney's fees, were denied. So she specifically denied every single one of Mr. Hilton's counterclaims during the arbitration. Those counterclaims included fraud, breach of contract, a laundry list of other things, and then there was an affirmative defense of fraud. It was number 2 or 3. It is on page 181, if I'm remembering it correctly. Excuse me, it's on page 182, paragraph 6. Defendant would show that plaintiff's lien claim and claim for arbitration is based at least in part on documents not signed by the defendant and not previously included in the agreement of the parties. You'll see in the reporter's record that we discussed this extensively with Judge Chubb. This matter has been heard by Judge Chubb in the context of our hearing in October of 2020, and it was heard in detail by the arbitrator, and it was just overruled. I mean, it was, the court dismissed it. The final recitation that's relevant, that the arbitration award was granted in full settlement of all claims and counterclaims submitted to arbitration. Claims and counterclaims not expressly granted are expressly denied. So there's no basis at all for any of these arguments that there's something that was missing that didn't go to the arbitration or that the arbitration was improper. Mr. Hilton was represented by counsel who made a raft of counterclaims and counter allegations and affirmative defenses, and he simply just didn't carry his day. We presented this award, this arbitration award, in our first amended motion to confirm. There was a response, but the response did not argue statutory vacature. The Texas Supreme Court pointed out in Hoskins v. Hoskins, 2016 case, that there are no longer any common law means to push back on confirmation of an arbitration award, that litigants are limited to the statutory requirements of 171.088 of the Texas Rules, Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 171.088. I'm miscitingthat law, but it's 171.088. And trial court shall confirm is what that says, unless vacature is proven by opposing party. So at the hearing, my burden for my client was to present a valid motion to confirm and an award, which we did. Opposing counsel's burden was to argue, to plead and prove a basis for vacature, which he did not. I think he confirmed as much as during his argument. But the bases are limited to corruption, fraud, undue means, prejudice of rights, exceeding powers, refusal unreasonably to admit evidence, conduct so substantially prejudices a party, or something where there's no agreement to arbitrate. And under the FAA, those are the TAA, under the FAA, it's corruption, fraud, undue means, misconduct, and that the arbitrator exceeded or so imperfectly executed her authority that there was really no final definite award. I think a review of the actual award itself shows that none of those were the case. The court made findings of fact and conclusions of law in support of the fact that we went to arbitration and that the award was valid. And there are too many of them to cover in the 6 or so minutes that I have remaining.
I've got a question. I understand you filed a motion to confirm and a first amendment motion to confirm, and you responded to their motion for summary judgment. But since you were relying on the affirmative defense of res judicata to their counterclaims, weren't you also under the burden to file your own motion for summary judgment on that basis?
There is, affirmative defense of res judicata has to be pled under, and I'm pulling something out of my head. I think it's Rule 297.
Not just pleading, but if you're moving for res judicata and you're trying to establish that affirmative defense for summary judgment, don't you also need to move affirmatively for summary judgment on that affirmative defense, and you did not do so here?
Yes and no. I think it's a little bit more nuanced than that, and nuance can be a word of avoidance. I'm not avoiding your question. I just want to explain it a little bit better. In our motion to confirm, there was no obligation for us to file anything about res judicata because there hadn't been anything brought up. Now, Mr. Drozombic, on behalf of Mr. Hilton, did respond to our motion. And in my reply to that motion, which you'll see at Clerk's Record 245, I did, at that point, plead res judicata as a defense to all of his post-arbitration pleadings, motions, et cetera.
But I mean in response to his counterclaim. If you want to defeat his counterclaim based on res judicata, don't you need to move for summary judgment on that affirmative defense?
I don't think so in this case, because once the order's confirmed, the case is over.
So you think the order confirming the arbitration award defeats his counterclaim? Is that what your argument is?
It defeats it. No, it doesn't defeat it. It doesn't go right back at it on the merits. It doesn't defeat it, but it moots it. Because if the case, he filed these things, one, he filed these pleadings months and months after the arbitration award was issued, months and months after we filed for confirmation. And once the court granted, once the court confirmed, that's it. That's ratifying the arbitration award and converting it into a judgment of the court. So I understand what you're saying, and I think that in a fairly normal setting, which this clearly wasn't, there would be the volley across the net of claim, counterclaim, et cetera, sure. But on the facts, and in particularly the procedure of this case, the way that this case went down, I don't think it was necessary, and I think it was mooted and potentially harmless error simply because the case was substantively over once the court confirmed our arbitration award.
Did you find any case law to support the fact that an order confirming an arbitration award defeats a counterclaim?
No, Your Honor.
Did you adjudicate all the claims at arbitration?
The counterclaims that he brought up after arbitration?
Mm-hmm.
No, he brought up two counterclaims after arbitration. One was Home Solicitation Act and one was 4102. And we did argue in the MSJ, in the response to the MSJ, we argued why those claims aren't availing. And in my response to the MSJ, I don't remember, but I think we might have argued res judicata there.
Why was the case, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Why was the case still live in front of the trial court? Why was there still a controversy once the trial court had confirmed the arbitration award? Isn't the case over at that point? Don't we have a finality at that point?
The court confirms the arbitration award. The case started with we filed the case, got the arbitration award, filed for confirmation, and then Attorney Fuller stopped responding. So eventually I just sent him an email saying, look, I'm filing this as opposed. And then on the eve of the hearing, Mr. Drozombic appeared and asked for an extension. And then as a result of his calendar, my calendar, health issues, it just
came. I see. On. Okay.
Was there any language in the agreement to arbitrate and or the arbitration award that says that this settled all disputes between the respective parties?
In the agreement to arbitrate, no. In the award states, this is page 151 of the clerk's record, this award is in full settlement of all claims and counterclaims submitted to this arbitration. All claims and counterclaims not expressly granted herein are hereby denied. So there seems to be an effective Mother Hubbard clause, which would trigger res judicata. These claims that we're talking about, this Home Solicitation Act, the 4102 thing, those are both claims that Mr. Fuller could have brought, but elected not to. I think part of the reason we're here is that post-arbitration, there's disagreement post-arbitration as to what the trial strategy should have been during arbitration. But I don't think that matters. I don't think it's relevant. He was represented by company counsel. Company counsel filed a raft of counterclaims against us, including signature fraud breach, et cetera. He just elected not to file those two particular claims.
And then there's an arbitration award that has a Mother Hubbard language in it, and then these counterclaims come up after the fact.
And it also has the language, the counterclaims are responded, including requests for attorney's fees are denied. And we went through the trial court page 180, went through the various counterclaims like we have with this court, notably the ones that are really the big issues, the breach, the fraud allegations, and the allegation of the fraudulent signature, were all presented to the arbitrator, as you can see in Mr. Fuller's answer, which is at page 180, and they were just simply overruled. Now, the court's order has a more traditional, the final judgment from the court has a more traditional Mother Hubbard clause, which fully and finally resolves all parties' claims and causes of action.
One quick question. The assertion that he did not, that it was a fraudulent signature, it wasn't a signature on that one particular page, was that specifically addressed by the arbitrator and Judge Chupp? And if so, how did they address that, or what did they have to say about that?
In the 18 seconds I have remaining, Judge, may I briefly answer and then conclude?
Yes, please, quickly.
So your question was it presented to the arbitrator? And what was presented to the arbitrator was on page 182, paragraph 6, defendant, which is Mr. Hilton and the appellant here, would show that plaintiff's lien claim and claim for arbitration is based at least in part on documents not signed by the defendant and not previously included in the agreement of the parties. There is also claims of...
Well, I know it was presented, but the question is how did they, what was the response? Why, did they just ignore that or assertion?
Are you asking what actually happened?
Yeah, don't worry about it. It's, your time's up anyway, so it's okay. I can figure it out.
I was there, the court addressed it, we argued it, and she overruled it in her final answer.
Yeah.
We had some extensive time between parties arguing that.
Perfect. That's what I was alluding to.
And for the reasons that I presented to the court today and for the reasons which are included in our brief, would ask the court to confirm the motion, to confirm the arbitration award, and to deny all the relief that appellant is seeking both here in his brief and in all of his post-arbitration practice.
Okay.
Please the court briefly. Some of the items I'd like to point out is counsel's argument that the award is properly confirmed because the statute says you confirm it unless all of these other things happen and you derail it. But somewhere in the confirmation process, how do you get that in front of the court? I agree that if something is brought to the court properly, be it authenticated, based on an agreement to arbitrate, or any of those things, then that would be true. But how can you say something is properly confirmed when a litigant comes to court and says, look, got my award, confirm it? There's got to be some sort of authentication. And that didn't happen here. And had they brought it as a summary judgment, had they brought something to authenticate it, had they filed a business record affidavit, we could make all of those arguments, but none of that happened. It wasn't properly confirmed because it wasn't properly before the court. Now, one of the things that's interesting is this is an arbitrator using their rules that says, hey, we can determine, if we want, whether you agreed or not. But that's not what Texas case law says. Our case law says that matter, to determine if an agreement to arbitrate exists, is in the province of the trial court. And the trial court didn't make that decision because nobody brought it to the trial court's attention. And the arbitrator exceeded her authority. Now, it would have been a good day had I got here before 90 days, and I could have pled all of that about exceeding the authority and those other things that would have been brought within that 90-day window, but I did not. But that doesn't cure the lack of proper evidence to authenticate the award. It doesn't cure the jurisdictional issue. It doesn't cure the affirmative defenses upon which the plaintiff relies, res judicata, waiver. It doesn't have anything that is shown as a matter of pleading and proof of any of those issues. And It doesn't show why the award and all of those things are not hearsay. The findings of the trial court that are based on the arbitration award are as though the trial court was there and analyzed the award. But that didn't happen, and the trial court should not have made those findings. Now, one of the things that was brought up in my earlier argument and by counsel is that if there is an agreement and the parties agree, well, if two parties agree that, yes, we've agreed to arbitrate, let's go, that issue will not come up. But if one of them says, my signature's a forgery, that's a different thing altogether because there is no agreement to arbitrate. The parties did not agree. I can't comment on what the prior counsel did with that. I have no idea.
But you know he showed up for arbitration and arbitrated that issue.
I know that he did show up, and based on the records that the plaintiff has filed, it would appear that they've arbitrated all of those issues. Whether or not there was authority or an agreement, they did arbitrate.
Well, the fact that they showed up shows that there's an agreement.
You know, I can't say that the appellant was brought to the argument or the proceeding kicking and screaming. I don't know.
Well, you would concede he wasn't compelled to do it by the court.
I would concede that. And, in fact, the court said that on the record, that I didn't enforce any agreement. That's correct. The trial court did not. One of the things we brought up during that argument were the fact that the contract is void under the Home Solicitation Act. It's void under the insurance code. And the court asked, well, if that whole thing is void, then aren't we out of here? And there are cases that exist in Texas that say, well, not really, because whether or not the contract is valid under the home solicitation or the insurance code can be determined by the arbitrator. But we never get the agreement to arbitrate. It wasn't there. Thank you.
Thank you. Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument here today. It's been helpful to the court. Your case has been submitted, and you're now free to go about your business. Thank you.